on behalf of BCHPCA, it's my honor and delight to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Doris Barwich. Doris is the inaugural executive director of the BC Center for Palliative Care, which opened within the Institute of Health Sustainability and Transformation in 2014. She's an experienced palliative care clinician and an educator for more than 24 years and served as the program medical director for Fraser Health's end-of-life care program from 2001 through to 2014. She's also a palliative care consultant to BC Cancer Agency, where she provides support in its pain and symptom management program. Doris is recognized for her advocacy and leadership on a variety of provincial and national palliative end-of-life care initiatives. She's a past president of the Canadian Society of Palliative Care Physicians and is involved in a number of research initiatives that focus on advanced care planning, the palliative approach to care within primary care and other specialties, as well as community engagement. Please welcome Dr. Doris Barwich.
So good morning. It's a real pleasure to speak to you today, but it's a bit of a tough act to follow these two gentlemen who've really painted such a large picture for us in terms of our future and in terms of our challenges. What I'm planning to do in this session is to just present a little bit of our current context. So I'm a physician. I started off as a family physician, and I started off in a holistic health center, a community-based health center, which was largely adopted by the Native, the First Nations community in Winnipeg in that time, and literally became a place where we focused not only on problems, but also on strengths and how to mobilize those. And I think that that's really the challenge as we look at that today. I then came into a palliative care context. I started in a freestanding hospice in South Africa. And what they did there was very interesting. All the staff and all the volunteers and all the public who were interested could engage together in a 60-hour training program. We did it as a small group with the facilitator, and every time someone would talk, we would reflect together on what we had heard, and we became a very tight community of people who were learning about and thinking about palliative care. And at the end, we were all evaluated with the same question. If you were dying, would you want this person around the table to be caring for you? And there were some people who were excellent other things, but might not be those people you would want alongside, and that there were other people coming from a wide variety of backgrounds who would be exactly the kind of people. And so as I talk today, I think I'm talking to an audience of those kind of people. We've learned and we know how to come alongside. And just a minute, I think I have to do it this way. Okay. It's not happening here. It's gone into.
Excuse me. Just have to get out of that. And you just use your arrow keys.
Okay. All right. So I'm talking the kind of people for whom this is what we do and this is what we know. And what we're here together to learn about at this conference is how to take what we know and what we do and how to take that out into that bigger world, our society, our cultures, whatever culture we're working in, and make the change happen that we know needs to happen. So I'll talk about the current context, some of the strategies at a national level, and some of the ways in which we've been leading already and will continue to lead in British Columbia. So part of our context is this aging population, the baby boomer generation, who are going to live longer with multiple chronic conditions and multiple transitions in care. And as when we did this talk 5 years ago, we talk about, you know, we think that by the time we're going to get there, death may be an option and we could kind of exercise. But despite medical advances, it's still not optional. It's something that's there for all of us. And I think right now the conversation around death and dying and aging has really changed. Everywhere I go, I'm hearing about the Being Mortal book by Atul Gawande. How many people in this room have read that book? So many of us and many people who are not part of our world have read this book. And so really one of the things he makes really clear is that medicalizing aging and dying can get in the way of living well and dying well. So again, the really key importance of the message that we bring. And we've always known this, and every study that we do just confirms this in a different way. We know what our patient priorities are. They want not to be worried about pain and other symptoms. They want to have a sense of control, and Dr. Hancock spoke to that really well. They want a clear approach to decisions and roles and who's going to be doing what and what am I responsible for, what help can I count on, what support is available for me. They want this to be a time where relationships are strengthened. They don't want to be a burden, but sometimes that sense of being in relationship, in family, in community, needs to be reframed, and they need to help be helped to come to a new understanding of how that works. They want to have a sense of continuity of self, that there's purpose and meaning, and they want to be given opportunity for life completion. And what we know is, if the emphasis remains only on what are we going to do or not do medically, there is a lot of missed opportunity and a lot of harm done, because these tasks associated with the dying role really often aren't accomplished. We have a very proud tradition in Canada. In fact, the term palliative care was coined by Balfour Mount in 1984 in Canada. So this whole hospice palliative care movement, we have a huge stake in that. We also now have a different context in that the Supreme Court in February of 2015 legalized physician-assisted death in Canada. There's a one-year delay to allow for development of guidelines and legislation, and so we are going to function in a very different end-of-life care context as palliative care providers in a year from now. We know that in jurisdictions where physician-assisted death has been legal, that in Oregon, for instance, it's 0.2% of deaths, and about 3%, this is an older statistic, I think it's now up to about 4.5% of deaths in the Netherlands. So it's certainly not the majority of deaths. It's not the option most people choose, but it is going to be part of the continuum of end-of-life care. And we need to deal with it. And certainly in the literature, for instance, in Washington State and in other places where this has been legalized, has caused a lot of discussion at a hospice society level, et cetera, to say, what are we going to do about this? How do we respond? How do we support people who may make choices that either are not consistent with our own values? This, however, this debate that I've been quite involved in because of my national involvements has led to renewed calls for a national palliative care strategy. It's actually helped to focus attention on the fact that currently only about 30% of dying Canadians have access to palliative care education or supports, and that that's a huge problem that needs to be addressed. We also have no standards of care. We're not, we haven't had like the NHS an end-of-life care strategy. We haven't had some of the things in other jurisdictions that make this a mandated part of care with quality standards and things that have been developed over time. We have no idea of even that 30% of care that is available, what's the quality of that care? Who is providing it? We know we have a huge dependence on family caregivers, and we know that that's unsustainable in the future. This led the Quality End-of-Life Care Coalition in Canada to publish a blueprint for action in 2010 with this statement: hospice palliative care in Canada remains at the margins of the healthcare system. Concerned citizens, advocacy organizations, and local champions will continue to be the agents of change. And I think that's a call to action for all of us with this new vision that we've just received, to actually consider that if it's going to change, that needs to be us making the change happen and continuing to advocate as we have and champion the changes. The four priorities coming out of that document were these, and I'll speak briefly to each of those just to give a bit of an overview of what has been happening and what is happening. So access being the first priority, support for family caregivers, development of standards, best practices, and education, and then encouragement for Canadians to discuss and plan for end-of-life care. The other thing that happened in 2010, which has really caused a sea change in terms of how palliative care is thought about by the larger community, is this study. So Dr. Jennifer Temel, based at Harvard, did a study, and basically they took cancer patients who were newly diagnosed with lung cancer in their cancer care settings, and they assigned them to one of two groups. Usual care in Harvard should be pretty good. Usual care plus palliative care. And what they found is when they looked at those two groups, the palliative care cohort had improved quality of life, improved satisfaction with care, and a surprise finding was they lived longer. So palliative care no longer associated with death and dying, but palliative care really for the first time in the literature being shown quite clearly to improve not just the quality of life, but potentially also the length of life. That was followed up by several studies, and this study I found very interesting. Dr. Jung looked in detail. She analyzed kind of the information about what happened in that palliative care consultation that made that kind of difference. What did they do that led to this kind of result with 20 patients? And they looked, what they found was that palliative care providers took time to build rapport and trust in relationship. They managed the pain and other distressing symptoms that were in the way, and they strengthened coping and integrated psychosocial aspects. They looked not just at the patient, but at the family. They provided a roadmap, and they promoted illness understanding and prognostic awareness, and they did it in a sensitive, time-responsive way. So they didn't, you know, at the beginning, their two patient groups were very similar, but as they moved forward, the palliative care group gradually grew in their understanding of what was happening, what their options were, what the treatment benefits and choices were, and as they chose less aggressive options, they lived longer. And you'll hear that repeated through my talk. So this led to calls for this improved access to palliative care and an initiative under the Quality End of Life Coalition called the Way Forward Initiative, which was really saying we need an integrated palliative approach to care. Things we've been talking about, meeting a person and family's full range of needs, physical, psychosocial, and spiritual, at all stages, not just at the end stages, but at all stages of frailty or chronic illness. And so that really that initiative gathered a huge body of evidence, gathered stories and case studies about people who had implemented this and published their results. And when they shared some of that with the public was very encouraged and believed that 87% of people should have access to early palliative care, and that 94% of the public believed it should include all care providers. That this is so not just a program. So palliative care no longer synonymous with end-of-life care, and palliative care not just as a program, but something that really is embedded in our healthcare system, that's integrated into the care that is provided by every single care provider that you encounter in all settings and for all diagnoses, and that care would be integrated and there would be collaborated in a way that would be seamless for those patients. So we as healthcare providers needing to find a way to share the road and benefit from the knowledge that each of us brings as healthcare providers, as hospice volunteers, as the public, and really bring that together in a way that makes the difference. This led Dr. Pippa Hawley to kind of develop the Bowtie Model, which is published in the Way Forward Initiative. And this looks like a very busy slide, and I don't know if Pippa's still here. There she is. But essentially looking at what happens under disease management. And when we presented this at a national meeting recently, there were several patients in the audience, they were quite horrified because they had assumed that the things we take for granted within a palliative care context would be automatically provided if needed. And they did not realize that at this point in where we are in our healthcare system, unless you're involving palliative care providers, you may not receive attention to psychosocial issues or a roadmap for care or a kind of care that promotes illness understanding in a way that helps you make good decisions. The other implication is if we focus just on what happens within the palliative care domain, if we're introducing it early in the disease, we don't know what the outcome will be. And so a percentage of those people will survive, will live long with chronic illness, chronic pain, and other issues. And so this really clear sense, and this is really very important for us to understand, because this is a really important change in how we conceive of palliative care, this moving away from this integration and palliative care and end-of-life care being quite synonymous, and for a number of reasons needing to separate these things. So palliative care, part of the continuum of end-of-life care, but palliative care also potentially helping those who are going to live with their disease live well until death, which is still inevitable, but may not be an outcome of this episode of care, and may include survivorship, and also the real importance of including bereavement follow-up, which, as has been mentioned, is often not part of what's included in sort of traditional, particularly in the U.S., where their palliative care programs, our services are often hospital-based, and then hospice happens in communities. Bereavement may not be part of that continuum. So I think it's important for us to understand some of these things that are happening in our context and making changes in terms of how we're thinking about things. Support for family caregivers, and I'm not going to talk a lot about that to this audience except to say that there's real increasing value being put on this, that we need to support the quality of living well in the context of a terminal illness, but also the quality of dying for those family members who need to carry on with life. It's in the midst of life. They need to we need to be, as Alan said, comfortable with the loss and the grief and know how to help people move on. And that needs to focus on bereavement and partnerships with groups like the Family Caregiver Network and others who are coming alongside those who are living with and providing the care for patients. The third thing they talked about was improving the quality of care and education. And within British Columbia and within most of North America, the way we talk about quality now is framed by this thing called the triple aim, which means that we're not just trying to improve care for that individual patient or family, but that we're really looking at better health for a population. And so very much lays the groundwork for what we've heard. I think this is all consistent with what we've heard this morning, just coming at it from slightly different perspectives. We need to focus on the health of all of our populations, and that really helps us look at what are the impacts on bereaved family members, what is the impact on society of the choices that may be made, and sustainability. There's a TED Talk that basically says that if we don't change societal expectations around how care is delivered, that we will bankrupt our healthcare system. We will not be able to have our kids go to college, and we will not be able to afford basic things because we are, you know, kind of having expectations that everyone should have access to intensive care and all of these options that really have been proven not to actually improve life at all. So palliative care meets the triple aim. There's improved quality of care. Patients and families are better informed of options, more in control, more satisfied with care. There's better long-term outcomes for bereaved relatives. And this is a huge piece of information when we're dealing with our medical colleagues who are only often looking at episodes of care. And when I spoke to some of my critical care colleagues, they had no idea that if someone pursued sort of more of a critical care pathway versus a palliative care pathway, that those family members 6 months later were suffering with depression, post-traumatic stress, anxiety, that what they did then had these long-term outcomes, and I think again lends a lot of support to the palliative health approach, as well as a reduced health system cost, more appropriate utilization. This is an educational initiative that many of you, I think, have been part of in your communities, which was really saying, so how do we take this theory and apply it? How do we equip our family physicians with a roadmap of how to do this care? This was the end-of-life module under the Practice Support Program that many of us participated in helping to develop and steer through implementation and evaluation. It's reached about 50% of GPs in this province, and when it was rolled out in every community, would involve local home health providers as well as palliative care providers, patients from the Patient Voices Network, and really was developed with all of those voices to help to say, how do we identify those who need a palliative care approach? And the commonest way of doing that is to tap into intuition. When you look at someone and you say, I wouldn't be surprised if they were not with us in 6 or 12 months, that's a person that needs more intensive, proactive care and implementation of the palliative approach to care. Assessment tools, which not only include where is this person at, what's their functional status, what's their symptom burden, but what are their goals of care? And what are the domains of care, which means also looking at the caregiver and the burden there. So trying to put these very practical tools in. And behind this one-page roadmap, which looks very, very busy, is about 200 pages. And every single box represents a link. So if you're not sure what the seniors assessment tool is, you press on it and the tool comes up. If you're not sure what are the domains of care I should be thinking about, you press on it and it comes up. What are the roles? How can I be using my nursing colleagues, my social worker colleagues, my volunteer coordinators? You press on that button and the information comes up. And this has been contextualized for every health authority in BC with a list of all the local resources and supports that are available. So a wonderful tool to help family physicians really begin to see their important role in this, but also what resources are available to them in terms of referral. And also the ways in which that changes as people approach the end of life and different services and different tools need to be accessed and used. The other thing that we've done, Dr. Francis Lau and I were co-PIs on a research study which took this information and we've done the work to put it into the 4 most common electronic medical records of family physicians. And so now we've built the capacity to measure what is happening, what are the gaps, how do we make improvement happen, is it improving, with the goal of actually changing long-term outcomes and population health. So I think this is one way in which we've translated some of that philosophical understanding of what needs to happen into a very practical tool and resource for how do we make it happen. The other group that's really working on making change happen is the iPanel group, which is doing a lot of research in various care settings about the palliative approach in nursing, and we'll hear later today from Della Roberts. So again, BC really very much in a leadership role nationally and globally in terms of saying, this is what we need to do, how do we do it? Advanced care planning. So the public, when we asked them, 96% thought that it was important to have a conversation about their wishes for care. 34% had actually had a conversation, and only about 13% have completed an advanced care plan to communicate that planning. That's not changed very much. About 5, 6, 10 years ago was 11%, so it's usually in that range. It's maybe moved up a little bit, but not a lot. So somehow we need to move people from talking about and thinking about to doing something. Those who say they want to do something said that they would go to get more information from their doctors so that they could begin to plan and have these conversations so that the plans were based in their current context. And 80% feel that these conversations should start when they're healthy or have first been diagnosed. So very much consistent with what the plans are within British Columbia. Again, just briefly mention the research we've been doing, which basically showed us the initial study was the ACCEPT study. And again, with a very sick patient group, there was about 90% who'd had conversations. But when we asked them, how many of you have talked to your doctor about your wishes or your plans, only 30%. And these were hospitalized patients. And the most shocking thing was, what we found was, only 36% of the time did what they tell us they wanted agree with what was written in their chart. So 36% of the time is what you want actually reflected in the orders that are written in your chart. And so we began to develop a conceptual framework that said, not only do we need to have advanced care planning conversations, which need to occur early and throughout care, but we need to promote capacity for goals of care conversations on the right-hand side for you, where we're really contextualizing that and we're training doctors and nurses how to have these conversations and how to present options for care and treatment in a way that can make a difference, and then to promote documentation that actually ensures that there's agreement between what patients tell us they want, the conversations we've had, and then orders that can reflect that. So this kind of diagram, which shows that basically advanced care planning happens more in a societal context. As we enter into interactions around specific healthcare decision making and consent and informed consent, that happens in the healthcare system and needs to have these goals of care conversations with are just integrated into the routines of care. And in British Columbia, again, we've been leading in this area of developing a medical order set for scope of treatment, where then those conversations can be captured in a way that the healthcare can be consistent and delivered consistent with your goals and values. So just briefly, some more information about what's happening in BC. As we've been looking at some of these challenges, considering the information Alan and others have been bringing to us about this need to expand our vision beyond healthcare systems to compassionate communities. And BC has been a leader, and this is a busy slide, but just to say that this patients as partnership, patients as partners framework has been embedded within everything that's happening within our integrated primary and community care portfolios. That sense that we need to have that voice at the table and engage patients and empower patients, not just as the one person on a big committee, but actually as the third of the committee, speaking to, contributing their voice, their experience, their wisdom to what happens. This is kind of just a short themes of the end-of-life action plan that was released in 2013, redesign health services to deliver timely, coordinated end-of-life care, provide individuals, caregivers, and healthcare providers with palliative care information, education, tools, and resources, and then to measure whether we're doing that and whether we're doing a good job with that. And basically saying that our patients will have needs across a continuum, that 90% of their care will be at home, and so we need to strengthen their primary care component. But some may need hospice support, and we need to build services for that. And some may need complex care for a period of time in palliative care units or tertiary palliative care units. And so that really was reflected in the minister's mandate to double hospice spaces in British Columbia. To promote patient-centered care in this way that recognizes that those needs may change across the continuum. We did an analysis of our population and looked at their health needs at end of life. We looked at some of the current supports that are available, and the health authorities and the ministry and those of us at the end of life working group are working right hard right now to kind of make this a reality, to double hospice spaces, so acute tertiary palliative care unit beds, community hospice beds, and home-based palliative care services in British Columbia by 2020. So we need to start building now so that the capacity is there for the demand in the future. The BC Centre for Palliative Care, which is I'm the executive director of, was also formed in 2013 to be kind of a group that would come alongside the implementation of this end-of-life action plan. But our vision is a little bit broader than the healthcare system, which is excellence in compassionate care and supports for those living with advanced illness. And the mission is to enable public participation and innovation in the development of quality, patient and family-centered outcomes for all British Columbians living with and dying from advanced illness. Because there needs to be a place where we can have these conversations with the broader community, not just the healthcare providers. Our stakeholder consultation last year told us that there were five things they thought was important for the BC Centre: to integrate a palliative approach within the continuum of care, to enhance education for healthcare providers, incorporate a broader spectrum of palliative expertise. And what we were trying to say there, and what the group was trying to articulate, is our patients, our families have wisdom. They have experience that needs to contribute to how we develop, that sense that we need to have a much broader continuum of people planning what are we going to do and how are we going to do it. We need to measure and evaluate whether we're being successful, and we need to change societal perceptions. And I think everything we've heard today is about that. How do we do this whole big enchilada of all the things that need to happen? I'm going to finish with Atul Gawande again, and the sense that what we've been talking about since our very first speaker this morning is about an ethics of caring versus medicalized dying, about compassionate communities. What matters most for most people in the end is connection, belonging, and having dedication to a cause outside oneself. Living well with disability, dependence, and death requires resilience. It requires some support to embrace alternative ways to live, to find that connection, belonging, meaning, worth, and purpose. And I'll end with the words of Cecily Saunders: "You matter because you are you, and you matter to the end of your life. We will do all we can not only to help you die peacefully, but also to help you live until you die." Thank you.